Hello and welcome to the BizNews News Wrap. It's Tuesday, the 22nd of October. I'm Lucy Ferreira and I'll be taking you through the top news items on BizNews today, ranging from the BRICS summit in Russia to updates on SA Inc., Anglo-American, Sasol and Naspers, as well as views from the inimitable Oxford scholar R.W. Johnson on whether South African states should receive veto power if granted permanent seats on the UN Security Council. Remember that you can find the full versions of these interviews and articles on BizNews TV and radio. Let's kick off with Chris Stain in conversation with foreign policy analyst Sanusha Naidu on the 2024 BRICS summit being held in Russia at the moment. In the wake of international sanctions and increasing isolation following the Ukraine conflict, Russia aims to redefine its influence.
Thank you. What do you think Russian President Vladimir Putin hopes to get out of hosting this summit?
Well, I think definitely much more visibility, profiling. The fact that Russia has been isolated, especially after the Ukraine crisis and conflict, and there's been that sanctions against the business and the commercial transactions with Russia. I think what this does is that it elevates the platform for President Putin to say to countries that have been detractors of Russia for the longest time and has constantly used Russia's space as one to push back against Russia and say, hang on, you violated international law, actually makes it a very, very sweet spot for President Putin to be sitting at the BRICS, to be hosting it in Kazan, as well as to demonstrate to the world that, hey, heck, I don't have to come to your platform, but everybody comes to where I am as well. And I think if you look at that, it kind of pushes back against what has been this very, very acute and innocuous kind of debate about whether Russia still has convening power. Now, obviously, it's coming in through the BRICS, but I think the BRICS, like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and even in the context of the fact that the President Putin could not attend some of those UN meetings in September, etc., because of what this meant, it gives that kind of elevation of the world and the profile to the world of Russia. But it also is about the fact that it's a platform that Russia can use to constantly beat the brow of the West by saying, hang on, we can actually still do business. There are countries here that still want to do business with us. The sanctions haven't really hurt us. And I think what happens in the way that people have projected the narrative on Russia being this kind of sanction induced coma for Moscow, I think kind of gets to this point to say, well, if you're actually in Russia at a particular point in time, you see that people are going about their normal everyday lives, their business, etc. Yes, they can't use the SWIFT system, which is the international banking system that does transactions in terms of currency. You can't use that. And so when you're in Russia, you have to use a lot of hard currency. But it actually is interesting because it's also about how do you change a perception of a country. So I think the fact of the matter is you've got almost around about 38 countries in some way or form that have been invited to attend this summit, 32 of them which have confirmed their attendance, 24 of them which are essentially going to be sending heads of state. We may not all agree with those that are attending. However, I think this is really a moment in the sun for Russia to say we still have traction.
And then with confidence levels in South Africa's banking sector on the rise and the government of national unity bringing optimism, local markets are seeing signs of improvement. But are international investors starting to take notice? Alec Hogg spoke with the CEO of Anchor Capital, Peter Armitage, who takes us through the factors driving this trend of cautious optimism.
Yeah, I think yesterday we were looking at the banking sector, which is up about 30% off its lows of a few months ago. But almost all of that has come from a change in rating as opposed to a change in forward earnings expectations. So it really is all just about confidence levels improving. On the ground, we're starting to see some benefit coming through from all the good things that are going on. But I think a much more positive vibe, people prepared to employ, people prepared to spend a bit more money. And it's really a confluence of factors. The government of national unity, interest rates are starting to come down. We've seen about 25 billion rand come in from the two-pot retirement system. And we haven't had load shedding for 200 days. So I think, you know, it's really great to feel that way, because the last 6-7 years we've been feeling negative in the SA markets. And I think, like most of the fund managers out there, the confluence of factors coming together now are making for a very powerful cocktail.
If you have a look overseas, and we do take our direction from the United States, they've been powering ahead year to date. The S&P's up 23%. Last week was its sixth consecutive weekly gain. It's almost like what's going on in geopolitics around the world doesn't seem to be scaring investors at all. Also, going back to that fund manager survey, there was a distinct movement from international markets to local markets in recent months by fund managers. But I'm wondering whether you're seeing international investors starting to nibble at South Africa, given everybody knows that America, as you've just articulated, is in high territory, that one should be looking for better value elsewhere. And I guess South Africa must be among them.
Yeah, so quite a bit of money is flowed into the bond market. So over 40 billion rand of foreign money is flowed into the bond market, where, and guys have done very well. Bond funds up about 20% this year as bond yields have come down. Bonds are easy because it's just a simple interest rate calculation. Companies are more difficult because there's company fundamentals and, you know, underlying growth in the country. So you haven't seen an en masse entry of foreign investors into the SM market yet. I think they're waiting to see some evidence of the sustainability of the GNU and the impact of all the things that I'm talking about coming through in earnings. And we are at quite a delicate stage in South Africa, where South African fund managers have got confidence because they can look forward. Foreigners are a little bit more skeptical, perhaps. You know, if you think back to the last Ramaphosa episode, share prices went charging upwards, but nothing really changed on the ground. So I think there's, you know, we think we're leveling off a bit in the SA market. But if we can get another leg and all of the stories that the fund managers are now telling comes to pass and flows through in South African earnings, there can still be quite another big jump. South African shares are still, you know, less than half the price of American shares for the same rand or dollar of earnings.
And then taking a deeper look at South African stocks, 361 portfolio manager Stephen Hurwitz unpacks the unusual 100-day trading update from Naspers CEO Fabricio Bloisi.
Stephen, the share price of Prosus was down 1% in South Africa, nearly 0.9% in euros. It certainly wouldn't have been the reaction that the company might have wanted after such a disclosure.
In the case of Naspers and Prosus, the majority of the value is still driven by Tencent, which is their largest investment. It accounts for $120 billion of nearly $150 billion in NAV. So for the time being, a lot of these other things, while they definitely are helpful, they're not going to necessarily dictate the direction of the Naspers and Prosus share price. That's going to be dictated by Tencent. Over the past couple of years, what caused the discount to blow out was poor capital allocation. So hopefully the discount will narrow over time if Fabricio manages to accomplish what he set out to do. But over the short term, it's mostly going to be driven by what happens to Tencent.
Are you feeling as though you can believe the statements that he's making, the projections that he's making, given that Naspers and Prosus are so important in South African portfolios?
I am very optimistic about what Fabricio has planned for the next couple of years. I met him initially after he was appointed as CEO, and it was very refreshing to see someone join the business who had a ton of energy and was very excited about the prospects for the company. But ultimately, as I said earlier, most of the value will be generated by Tencent. And we are cognizant of some of the macroeconomic challenges that China has, as well as some of the geopolitical challenges that are currently taking place, especially if Trump were to be elected as US president.
Yeah, so that would not be a bullish factor, a Trump presidency for this company.
No, probably not.
When you just go a little or dig a little deeper into the numbers, He's talking about the profits, or earnings before interest and tax, being three times higher for the first half of this year than the year before. That looks pretty impressive, and I guess that it might finally be hitting its straps.
So it is quite easy to triple your profits when it comes off a very small number. So last year it was, I think, just under $30 million. So I think they're targeting about $100 million for the first half of this year. But you'll actually see much bigger growth in the second half, because if they do hit their targets, that implies that the second half will actually grow three times faster than the first half. So finally, the company is starting to look like they're going to be generating free cash flow, which will be a huge positive, because before, the company totally relied on their dividend from Tencent to invest in the rest of the portfolio. And now, for the first time ever, it looks like the rest of the portfolio is also going to be contributing positively.
And commodities garner more interest among shareholders and investors. Veteran mining maven Peter Major of Modern Corporate Solutions takes us through his views on Anglo American and Sasol.
But I am positive, Alec. I think the guys have been way too harsh on Anglos and on Duncan. And it brings back memories of Tony Trayer. And, you know, Tony Trayer was conservative. He sort of missed the initial boom. And what did he do? Nothing. And that's what a good fund manager should do. If you think you missed something, but you're not quite sure, do nothing. So he didn't do anything. And Cynthia Carroll took over, and she immediately started buying a whole bunch of assets. Then you had the great big correction. And had Tony Trayer still been in power then, which is only a year and a half, 2 years later, geez, Anglos would have been choking on cash. All the mining houses and companies fell 70, 80%. He could have bought anything he wanted for 20 cents on the buck. So Duncan's not quite in that position, but he's in a good position. Anglos is in good shape. They've always had great assets, and there's no need to panic.
So perhaps you can give us some thoughts on what you think of Sasol right now, given it certainly isn't overpriced.
No, it's not overpriced, but Sasol is as much a victim as the new South African government as it is to the worldwide changing events. And some of those changing events are trying to clean up the environment, which means oil from coal is not a big plus. But it's oil from gas technology was world leading, and it was making an effort to get involved in that internationally. It is making an effort to diversify internationally, because as we've seen, anybody staying in this country is just subject to so much shifting of regulations, policy, bad infrastructure, moody, temperamental government decisions, short-sighted decisions. You know, it is virtually suicide to have all your assets in this country. It's really close to corporate suicide. Warren Buffett's always bragged up the virtues of diversification. Now, that doesn't mean willy-nilly run out and just buy stuff. So poor Sasol, they are subject to a lot of the troubles that other local companies have, and they've got the ESG coming against them, because environmentally, geez, they were right at the top of the list. But you'd think they had decades of pretty good management, decades of real innovative breakthroughs. And boy, they built things that people were talking about. They built things that very few people could even imagine. So they had that capability. I don't know how much they've lost it. I don't want to put them in the ISCOR category yet.
In global affairs, the ongoing debate around UN reform has brought renewed attention to the question of veto powers on the Security Council. With calls for African states to be granted permanent seats, there's growing discourse over whether these nations should also have veto power, a privilege currently reserved for just five global powers. In his thought-provoking piece, R.W. Johnson delves into this issue, questioning whether Africa's geopolitical standing justifies such demands.
There has recently been an outburst of what one can call preemptive indignation over the question of whether African states, if invited to take up permanent seats on the Security Council, should have veto powers or not. Several local black journalists have written angry columns saying that if Africans are not offered veto powers, this would be tantamount to their being told that they are second-class citizens, and accordingly they should refuse to serve on the council at all. This is putting several carts before the horse. The suggestion made by the British and American delegates is that the Security Council be enlarged to include, as permanent members, Germany, Japan, Brazil, and India, plus two African states which would represent Africa as a whole. The first thing to note about this is that Japan and Germany have the third and fourth largest economies in the world, that India is the world's most populous nation and the fifth largest economy, and that Brazil is the giant of Latin America, the world's eighth biggest economy and 215 million people. In other words, these are chosen as great powers, joining the five great powers already on the Security Council. In addition, there are 10 non-permanent members, currently including three African states. None of the black journalists whom I have read have paid attention to the fact that great powers have existed throughout history. The UN tries to cope with this reality by giving all states equal rights in the General Assembly, but preserving great power rights in the Security Council. This was done not only because no other arrangement was workable, but because without it, great powers would not have joined the UN at all. That had happened to the League of Nations and had doomed that body to irrelevance, a fate which the UN's founders were desperate to avoid. A second point is that as yet no one has suggested that the new permanent great powers, India, Japan, Germany, and Brazil, should have veto powers. Indeed, it seems certain that this won't happen. First, because having nine states with vetoes would virtually guarantee permanent paralysis. Second, because any reform has to be acceptable to the present great powers. If not, they'll veto it. Note that there are currently 193 member states in the UN. Only five have vetoes. The notion that means that the other 188 are all second-class citizens is just not tenable. And if even Germany, Japan, India, and Brazil don't get vetoes, how can one possibly argue that two African states should? There are, after all, no great powers in Africa or anything remotely near to that.
And that brings us to the end of today's news wrap. Remember that you can find all of these interviews and articles on biznews.com, TV and radio. See you tomorrow.